St. Cloud State University has been an integral part of the community of St. Cloud since its very beginning in 1869. In that time, St. Cloud State University has accumulated a vast amount of history, and as any institute of higher learning would do, they've recorded, sorted, and stored all of this information in their archives. And just recently, the SDSU Archive has made accessing that information as easy as logging onto a website. This is Jeff Carmack bringing you another installment of the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, and in today's feature, we're going to be sitting down with Tom Stamen as we discuss this new interactive and innovative tool that allows users to access information and photos, such as the groundbreaking for the Atwood Memorial Center, as well as information on performances, including Louis Armstrong, the Harlem Globetrotters, Pink Floyd, John Denver, and Elton John.
Well, why don't we start off and you can just let people know who you are and where we're at.
My name is Tom Stamen. I am the University Archivist here at St. Cloud State. I have been here since July of 2007. And I am the first professionally trained archivist hired here at St. Cloud State. The University Archives was established in March 1977.
Nice, nice. And you've just unveiled something on the university website. Tell us a little bit about that. This is kind of an interactive tool. It gives people an opportunity to explore some of the archives without actually coming up here.
Exactly. Because our time here is a little limited, our office hours are Monday through Friday, 8 to 4:30. We're on the third floor of Miller Center. So in the age of people wanting things instantly or at their fingertips immediately that we may not have when we're open during our regular office hours, the timeline is just one thing. I mean, there's lots of other things that we have done that people can access outside our office hours on the website. So the timelines was an idea that I had. I've had information about the timelines before, and I did have something on the website. It was just a PDF. It was like a listing from a Word document of dates and things that were going on. So I wanted to find something that was a bit more interactive, a bit more interesting, that would add a little flash and pizzazz to the timeline pieces that I've found over the years.
Yeah, so basically, for folks who don't know, you can go to your St. Cloud State University Archive website, and there's a timeline that you can scroll through with pictures, stories, all sorts of stuff. How far back does that go then?
Jeff, that goes back to 1869, and it goes up to, probably about 2006. We're a little lax on the stuff from the last few years, but some of it depends on the kinds of material that we have. So if we don't have records from the last few years, which often happens, then things aren't included.
Yeah, it takes a while for things to actually become archived once they happen.
Right.
So,
How
did you decide upon what goes into the timeline? What kind of examples of some of the things we have that have gone on at St. Cloud State?
It was actually an idea that I had. I was an archivist at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. And that was my first real full-time job, and I was at CWRU in Cleveland for almost 10 years. And we would always find bits and pieces of information that you're like, wow, did you know that Pink Floyd played at Emerson Gymnasium in 1970 in Cleveland on the campus of Case Western Reserve? And things like that, this building was put up, or this person arrived on campus, this president was at this time, or this well-known dean, or the school was established. So there was these bits and pieces in our brains that we decided to record. So when I left and came back to Minnesota, I continued that tradition of finding these, or just seeing these things, like, oh, Elton John was here in May 1973. Was it 73? Or Bob Hope was here in December 1976, and I bet you nobody remembers or knows about that. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to take the information that I found in the Chronicle and other publications, other records that we have here, and putting them into a timeline that people could explore. So it focuses really on buildings, events, and people. And it depends on, it's those buildings, events, and people, and it's what's sort of strikes me as interesting. So this is, the timeline is not complete by any means at all, but it was things that I thought people might be interested in. And not only being interested in it, we can go back and we can also edit. So they're saying, hey, Tom, did you think about this event or that person or this thing? We can simply go and we can add those easily enough.
It's nice, nice. About how long did it take you to put all this together then?
It took the time. You know, it took me a couple weeks to do that. I mean, the timeline, those are pieces I've been putting together for a long time, obviously. But putting that into something that is actually appealing and interesting and interactive took a few weeks. I worked on it over winter break some, and then some in January, and we finally, I had the web people had helped me with some of it, so they finally got to it, and that's why we were able to publish when we did.
Oh, nice. Nice integration of, you know, the days of yore with modern technology. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important for us to remember our history? Why do you think it's important for us to archive these things and be able to access them?
Well, it does take a lot of work to create the information that we create for our jobs. And I think at this university a bit, we forget about the traditions and the history of this place. So if you walked around and like, well, what was Stuart Hall? You know, who is that person named after? Shoemaker Hall. I think there's a lot of heritage, plenty of heritage on this campus that people should be aware of, should be proud of, should be publicized. So, you know, St. Cloud State isn't just some, you know, state school. It is some place that has a history, a long history that people should celebrate. And with the information that we have up here, my goal has always been to show people what we have. Now, I don't know if you've seen, Jeff, we have our physical exhibit out here. It's Famous Visitors, which is a subset of the timeline that I've done. And as I've mentioned, Elton John being here and Bob Hope and running across these things. And not only running across them, highlighting them, which highlights the heritage and the long history of this university, but the kinds of information that can be found in university archives. So, especially with our Famous Visitors exhibit, and which is a subset of our timeline, all the information, all the images came from university archives. So you can say, hey, wow, I didn't know Larry Linville from MASH, a.k.a. Frank Burns, was here in 1987, and there's information about it, and we have a bunch of images of him being here, so people can say, wow, I didn't know that, and can see, wow, maybe the University Archives can help me with some other project that I have or some other information that I seek.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's all Louis Armstrong out there, old Elton John, of course. Yeah, there's it takes up the whole window space along the edge there. So.
And there's a web version of it, too, that I created. And this was last summer. I had done this in the fall, the physical exhibit. So people don't get up here very often, third floor, so that's why we have a web version, which can be accessed at any time. I just want folks to know that there is a University Archives on campus, that the focus of our service here is St. Cloud State University. So we preserve and make accessible records that have to be kept long-term by the university. So if students or faculty or administrators are looking for information about the university and its history, I'm the guy to see. If it's not, if you have another question, that's what happens often. I've had students come up here looking for slave diaries from the Civil War or financial information for corporations. We don't have that, but we do have information about St. Cloud State University. And there is a lot of information available online. So, you know, I get it, you know, that people want to have this at their fingertips. So we've made accessible a lot of material that I believe that has some high value. Like, we have our course catalogs are available from 1869 to the last one, to one up to 2012. We have the entire run of the Normalia, which was the first student newspaper, which ran from 1892 to 1904. The Normal School Recorder, which was from 1916 to 1918. And then the Chronicle from 1924 to 1951. They're all available as downloadable PDFs. So you don't even have to come visit archives. You can go to our website and look at and find that information. As well as, 3,000 images. So that are available, you can keyword search them and download a version of the image to your desktop.
Wow, literally history at your fingertips. Ooh, there.
Absolutely, Jeff.
Not to put you on the spot or anything, but what's one of the oddest things that you found so far that's gone on at St. Cloud State?
It has put me on this oddest things, you know.
Or maybe a visitor or something along those lines.
You know, I don't know. I'd have to, that I would have to think about. I mean, there hasn't really been anything like scandalous. People always go, damn, you know, find any skeletons in the closet. I've never have found skeletons in the closet. The one that I would say almost found, which I would love to know, was a president in 1895 resigned. I think it was Joseph Carhart was here from 1890 or 1891 to 1895, and he resigned. And there are we do not know the circumstance of his resignation. There are I've read accounts that he resigned because he was having an affair with a student or a faculty member, but it's clear from the State College Board minutes at that time that whatever had been done and why it was done, those records were destroyed. So yeah. The mystery continues. We do not know how or why this president had left us, but there was apparently a scandalous reason. That's all I know. Or that's what, you know, we hear, but why, we don't know.
Yeah, this is one of those mysteries.
One of those mysteries that we'll never know. It's funny because I actually had contact with a relative of his, and I asked her that question, and she did not know. She had found it, the one image we have of him, had found that image that we have of him online, and she wanted a copy. And I don't remember exactly what else she wanted, but I had asked that question of her, and she did not know.
Yeah, I guess you're curious. Definitely, definitely.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC, and in today's news feature, sitting down with Tom Stamen, the St. Cloud State University archivist. We're talking about the new timeline that they've installed upon their website, as well as some of the more interesting aspects of St. Cloud State University history.
I always tell students, and you know, I never, you know, it's funny, I'm from Minnesota, and the first time I was on campus was when I interviewed for this job in 2007. And I have relatives in central Minnesota, and I never made it to campus, you know, which was a shame. But the one thing that I tell students about the origins of the school, and I used to teach an information media course, and we would do a little brief history about St. Cloud State University, and the students would just be shocked to find out how small campus really was. Until, you know, it wasn't until like the 50s that the campus really started growing. You know, it was right along the river. You had Lawrence, you had Old Main, you had Riverview, you know, Eastman a little later on, that it was right along the river. And I have never figured out, and I've looked for this, why Shoemaker was built across the street on First Avenue South. But, you know, besides Shoemaker, the campus was right along the river. And having students look at aerial photos of that time, seeing this was a large, vibrant neighborhood that once the campus started growing after World War II with the GI Bill and the baby boomers wanting to go to college, how the university started to march its way westward and taking over the homes and the property that was here. And there was ill will between the neighborhood and the university because the university was growing so quickly in the 50s and 60s. And I mean, the 60s, this place was a construction zone. I can't imagine what it was like. You're seeing all the construction at that time. But how residents would move, their house would be taken by the state, and then they would move a block or so away. And a few years later, that home would be taken away too because the university was expanding so much that it just blows my mind. And students just don't, you know, maybe they don't have that aspect of history because, you know, obviously they're from 18 to 22. Maybe they can't appreciate that quite yet. But showing them these images and talking about that time where, you know, there was a large neighborhood here. The university was quite small. It had, you know, maybe 1,000 students. And really didn't start growing until the 1950s. And how large the campus had got, and not only that, but telling them the history of the universities. I asked people, I said, "Why was this university founded?" And no one would raise their hand, or maybe they wouldn't admit it. But for the training of teachers, you know, that's why the state university system was founded. So Winona was the first, 1860. Mankato was the second, I think it was 1867. St. Cloud State, called the Third Normal School, 1869. And then after that, I always forget, it's Bemidji's in there. I think it was Moorhead, Bemidji, and Duluth. University of Minnesota Duluth was a state university, state college, until right after World War II, and the University of Minnesota took it over. But its main mission was to educate teachers for Minnesota public schools. So at a time, tuition was free. You would come to the university, you'd do 2 years or 4 years or 3 years or whatever the curriculum was at that time. Tuition was free, but you had to sign a pledge to teach in Minnesota public schools for 2 years. So that's how you paid the state back, was by teaching in Minnesota public schools. So now on the back, we have we have transcripts of students from the 1870s to the 1930s. There's like 20,000 names, which we've indexed and are made available online in a PDF. And we get a lot of requests for genealogical information because people find it on Google. So the university, we have these transcripts in the back, and on there they sign this pledge to teach in Minnesota public schools. And when they do, that someone had wrote in handwriting redeemed. And if they didn't, I don't know if they didn't, I don't know what happened. How the state was able to get to recoup that cost, but that's how the state public school system was populated with teachers. So when I tell them, all right, Riverview used to be a model school, and they ask, well, what's a model school? Well, that's where the teachers, the faculty on campus, would teach K through 8 or K through 9 or whatever it was at that time. The students then could watch the teachers teach, and then they could do their student teaching there as well.
Yeah, kind of like a lab school, if you will.
A lab school, exactly. A model school, lab school. So Riverview was completed in 1913 and then was replaced in 1958 by what is now called the Engineering and Computing Center. It used to be the Thomas J. Gray Campus Laboratory School. So if you ever walk in there and you wonder why it looks like a elementary school, well, in fact, it was an elementary school for 25 years and it closed in 1983.
Mm. Wow.
So there is a teaching, that teaching component still here on campus is obviously not, the main focus of the university anymore, but that really goes back to 1869 and the School of Education, the work that they've done now. The curriculum expanded after World War II to include other things besides education, but from 1869 to 1947, it was strictly the training of teachers.
When you think about it, what are the community needs? And, the university kind of reflects that. Up until that point, it's teaching teachers. Right. And then, after World War II, you get the baby boom and all that. And then all of a sudden there are other needs, so other programs arise.
Right.
And that's kind of the same way. I think it's still going today.
Right. It was interesting because after World War II, the University of Minnesota system, if I remember correctly, they believed that they would not be able to handle all the students, all the soldiers who wanted to go back, who wanted to go to college. So that's how the state university system started its transformation.
Got to find something for people to study.
Right, yeah. And you're right. I mean, society changes and the university and the university system adapted to the needs of the public.
Nice.
Want to talk about Herb Brooks?
Yeah, sure.
This hockey's been on the brain of a lot of people here. So it's funny, I always have to ask people, I always say people, you and I know who Herb Brooks is, probably about the same age, and we remember, I don't so much remember him being at the University of Minnesota, that was a little before my time, but obviously the U.S. Olympic gold medal men's team winning in 1988 at Lake Placid. And so I always have to ask students if they know who Herb Brooks is. And sometimes they do know who he is and sometimes that they don't. But I've been involved, or I've been hearing things about Herb Brooks and some of the remodeling and the renovation that's going on at the National Hockey Center, and how I'm pleased that they're going to be able and they're going to be using materials from university archives to show the heritage not only of the hockey program, which goes back to 1930, but of the history of the university itself. And I'm not sure how Herb Brooks will be involved with that somehow, but he will be. Obviously, Herb has passed away, but they'll be celebrating The one season that he was here in, it was the 1986-87 season. He was with the New York Rangers. And I think he'd been out of hockey for a year or two, I think. I don't remember, but he'd come here in 1986 to coach the team in its last year of Division III hockey. And he really lent his name by coming here and having the desire of the university to become a Division I hockey team. And it was funny, and I don't think this is any secret, but I had talked to Bob Motzko as part of this renovation project for the National Hockey Center, and he was telling this group how Herb Brooks, even though he was here that 1 year, 26 years ago, how much it impacts a hockey program today, and how when he would go on recruiting trips, he would mention that Herb Brooks was here, and parents would say, well, if Herb Brooks was there, St. Cloud State must be big time. So the university is still connecting itself to its past in the single season that Herb Brooks was here. And I certainly, as a Minnesotan who grew up watching and playing hockey, I can appreciate Herb's contributions to the state of hockey and to hockey in general, and how his impact of this university is still felt today, despite him being here one single season.
Yeah, they're doing pretty well this year. So
they really are, you know. And I'll admit, and I've admitted this to people, I'm a Gopher fan. So, yeah. but Herb Brooks, I mean, it is interesting in seeing and showing people these images of Herb being here that single year. And I had found an image of Bob Motzko was a student coach the year Herb was here, 1986-87. And I've been organizing the images of the university photographer. You can see some of my work here. But so they won that year. They won the Division III. They finished third place in the Division III Final Four hockey, men's hockey tournament. And I had some images scanned of, they must have like a celebration or something. So Herb and this other gentleman, Dave Rise, I can't remember his name. He was the other student coach holding the third place trophy. And then included in those images in that contact sheet, here's a photo of Herb Brooks with his arm around Bob Motzko. And I couldn't believe it. I could not believe I had found this. And I had just talked to this group and just talked to Coach Motzko. And you know, days later, I find this picture of him and Herb Brooks. So I thought it was great.
Well, that's a neat thing about history, and you know, and people actually taking pictures,
right?
And
I'm sure no one's ever seen these images before. I mean, we have thousands and thousands of images here, and I bet you 1% maybe people have seen, but otherwise, nobody's seen these before. And scanning them and making them available online so people can see and view them and download them if they want is just added value.
Well, right on. Well, thanks for talking with me today.
Welcome, Jeff. I appreciate it. And if there's anything else I can talk to you about with St. Cloud State history, I'm happy to do so at any time.
Oh, cool.
And we've been talking with Tom Stamen from St. Cloud State University Archives. For more information on the archives, you can find it online at the St. Cloud State University website by clicking on the library link on the top of the page and then clicking on the special collections. Or you can link to it directly off of our website at kvsc.org under the Podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota History link. This has been Jeff Carmack reporting for KVSC Radio, where we ourselves have a couple of items on the archive, including a very auspicious one on May 10th, 1967. This report was made possible through funding by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the Minnesota Cultural Legacy Amendment. It has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPRS. Diverse radio for Minnesota's communities.